on demand.
Hi, I'm Jim Stroud. Welcome to the Recruiter's Lounge. The Recruiter's Lounge is a podcast of news, interviews, and commentary on the recruiting industry, and it was designed with you in mind. So sit back, relax, and enjoy your time in the Recruiter's Lounge. Whenever I'm on the phone with my good friend Karen Madden, I always wish I had a tape recorder going because we get into so many interesting topics, especially when it comes to recruiting and especially when it comes to ethics in recruiting. Well, I decided to do just that and record a couple of phone conversations I had with Karen and post them in this segment that I'm calling He Said, She Said. So if you would, check it out. Let me know what you think and hear from you soon.
You're in Recruiter's Lounge today with Jim Stroud and my lovely, talented co-host, Karen Madden. How are you, Karen?
Hello, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well. we were talking earlier today about a couple things. We talk about so many things. Let me think what I'm thinking about. Oh. We were talking about how much money recruiters make and what the average was. And I was just sort of curious. And tell me about the article you saw the other day.
It was actually an article, and I think it was on Answers, no less. They were talking about the staffing industry and also permanent placement. And what I was really shocked, well, actually really wasn't shocked, but they were talking about the biggest, largest firms like the Spencer Stuarts and the huge corporations. Well, the average recruiter for them made about $1 million.
Stop. Rewind. Okay, now, say these are like big search firms you're quoting.
Uh-huh.
And they each make $1 million a piece. This is like executive.
Well, I didn't say that they each made $1 million a piece, but they were based on their net earnings, right? And based upon their net earnings and how many recruiters they had, they said the average recruiter basically was billing about $1 million to $1.5 million. So
wow.
Some people said they could have had a recruiter that was doing $2-3 million and a couple were doing a couple hundred thousand.
So the money in recruiting is with these big executive search firms?
Uh-huh.
Because from the corporate side, I'm not quite making $1 million a year.
I believe the corporate side is averaging about $75,000 to $100,000.
Hmm.
But, well, I mean, when you look at the fact that, for example, back in just 2004, just the staffing employment, temporary employment side was a $63 billion industry.
Wow.
And they were saying that, well, this is where it gets interesting, that they, in 2001, the temporary employment industry employed an average of 2.5 million people on any given day. And this is in the United States only.
A lot of mouths to feed.
That's a lot of mouths to feed. And they said the staffing industry is the top 10 largest staffing companies, captured 29% of the total $72 billion of the U.S. staffing market in 1998.
Wow.
So this industry is a tremendously, well, by the way, did I mention that this is the third fastest growing industry in the world?
The staffing industry is the third largest growing industry in the world?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's a lot
one?
Of people in this industry.
What's number one? Do you know?
No.
No?
I didn't. I wasn't interested in
number
one.
I would say, who's number one? Who's number two?
Oh, yeah. I mean, why everybody always wants the details?
I know.
I kind of focus on, I guess it's my ADHD sometimes. I focus on one thing and I get obsessed.
Okay, well,
with
you got the most important statistic. It's a growing industry and full of little hidden liabilities that people maybe don't know about or don't think about so much.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those little liabilities that come to mind are contract workers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, someone may want to hire a software engineer and put them on contract at one of their client sites and start collecting money based on their hourly wage and think all is right with the world until something vicious happens to them. What are some things that some of these smaller contingency search firms or retained search firms should be a little wary about when they put contract workers on a company site?
What a lot of staffing firms don't realize, now are we talking, when you say contingent, are we talking staffing firm that's placing temp to hire, or are we talking permanent? I want to make sure I clarify.
Let's go with both. Let's talk about both of them.
Well, let's go temp to hire first then.
Okay.
And temp to hire, what people don't realize is a staffing firm is a co-employer.
Okay.
And so many people who own a staffing firm they open up these firms and they think, oh, I can do as I please, I can do whatever I wish, and they don't realize that they're setting themselves up to liability if they don't have very good contracts. Let's say I place Andrew, and Andrew goes into the company, and Andrew decides to go ahead and sexually harass someone within the corporation. And let's say now that the staffing company does not have a contract with the company that says, hey, unless you tell me what Andrew's doing in that company, I should not be held liable. But because of that, they don't know what Andrew's doing. They don't realize the company hasn't done really much in regards to disciplinary aspects or issues, I mean, treating how he treats Andrew. So the only way Andrew, that the staffing company now knows that Andrew has done something wrong is because the young lady has complained to the EOC or the Department of Labor, and they get a nice, wonderful, warm letter that says, hey, we're going to give you 60 days to respond, and this is what has happened. Now, staffing companies are going to be held liable and share the responsibility because they're the employer on record as well of Andrew. The best thing a staffing firm should always do is to make sure that they consistently have the opportunity to come into the office and be able to say, we get, you know, discipline that individual so that when the EOC comes in and says, what did you do, they can say, hey, this is what we did. We took Andrew. We tried to put him in a different department. We tried to discipline. We moved him or removed him from the company, our position, whilst we investigated it, and we were helping in the investigation. If the staffing company doesn't have anything like that in their contract, well, now the company can't come in and is saying, hey, you didn't come in and you weren't being you doing your job. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah, so what if the staffing company just didn't make it aware? What if this? What if I put John Doe on the client's site? The client has an issue with the person I put on there, but they decide to just handle it, like you said, you know, disciplinary action before, and they just don't think to tell me. Now, is that ignorance of it does not excuse me from liability, correct?
Ignorance does. And the thing is, especially if you don't have it on your contract. If you put it in your contract that the company's supposed to tell you and they don't, then it does help you in your remedy.
Okay.
It does help. I didn't say it will help make it easier regarding the burden, but it doesn't take away all the liability because it's really your job to keep in touch with what's going on, too, with your employees. So that's your employee.
What if I just put something in the contract that says, more or less, this is your guy. Even though you're paying us, he's all your problem, not mine.
Can't do that.
Can't do that. Why not?
No, because that person is still going to be coming to you for employment, for his paycheck. You are still an employment. He's still your employee no matter what because you're the employer of record. You're a co-employer.
Okay.
So you can't get around. You see, a staffing firm can't hide behind a company, and a company can't hide behind a staffing firm. And that's what we see is going on a lot in this industry. You'll find that some large corporations out there today are still doing that. They will go ahead and call somebody a contractor. And the reason they're doing that is they don't want to pay either medical benefits or they'll go ahead and not want to pay overtime or et cetera, okay?
Right.
And they go ahead and say, we'll hide behind the staffing company and call this person a contractor, even though this person is really an employee. I mean, okay, let me explain the definition here.
Please do.
If a person is in your office 24/7, okay, he's coming into the office, you're giving them business cards, he's got a boss, he has to come into the desk, and you're telling him what to do, that's an employee.
And he has his own phone extension and all that.
That's an employee.
Okay.
You can't, if the person says, I'm sick or I don't want to work today, and then you fire them because they didn't want to work today, that's an employee. If you discipline them or tell them they have to come to meetings, especially that one, if you're telling them they have to come to meetings, that's an employee. A contractor is a person who's coming in there and you're letting them work for you under a contract. They're doing some additional work for you. Now, what the thing is, if they're an employee and you're not and you're misclassifying them, that means you're telling them they have to be at work from 8 to 5. And then you have them working there until 6, 7, and 8. Yeah, you've got to pay them overtime.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like in California, overtime is per day, not per 40 hours. So if a person works 8.5 hours, then that 0.5 hours is overtime.
Okay.
In other states, it's based on 40-hour weeks. Well, just because your company is headquartered in Minnesota, you have to use California law. And that's what some staffing companies and companies have done, too. They'll say, well, we're basing it upon our state law. You can't do that. It has to be based.
Why do they have to? Well, if they're in Texas,
mm-hmm.
Why do they have to use a California law?
Because if the candidate is in California, if the employee or contractor is in California, you have to use California law.
Also, it depends on where the contractor is.
Yeah, on
right,
where
so
the work or where the work is.
So if the contractor is in Maine and he's working virtually or traveling back and forth to California, then the California laws apply. But if he works virtually in Maine and then travels back and forth to Florida, then the California law doesn't apply.
No, exactly. I mean, it depends. I mean, if he's a California resident and he is W-2ing himself as a California resident, California law will apply.
Okay.
Okay. But if he is going to be working predominantly in Florida, now this is kind of grainy here. I mean, I'm not going to be sure about this, but I can bet that the law that has the strictest regulations will apply because it depends on where he's W-2ing himself as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if he's getting his paycheck for California and he's claiming his taxes based in California, then that has to be done by California law. But, again, you got to look at this aspect, too. He's a California resident, and just because you're using the staffing form in Wisconsin, you're still going to have to use California law because that individual's a California resident, and he's got to pay California taxes.
What's a good general rule for a company to sort of keep in mind? I guess to rephrase another way, what's the most a company can get away with, just in generality, as far as dealing with contractors?
Oh,
because
yeah.
I know some people are thinking that. I mean, even I want to say it, but that's what they're thinking. Like, okay, how can I just in general be safe when I'm placing these contractors on these company sites?
Just,
I mean, put in a contract.
Well,
you
I don't know.
Tell
I mean,
me
I
what they're doing.
I was going to use an outsourcing firm once because I wanted to place a contractor, okay? And I was going to use this outsourcing firm to let them be the employer of record, to keep it off of me, okay? But then I realized, I was still going to have some burden anyways. I still had some liability and responsibility, not as much as what the employment record, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that was interesting, they wouldn't do work in California because California laws were so strict. The main thing I would say,
Stay away from California.
They didn't want it. They did not. They said California laws were too strict. The workman's comp was too strict. No way they did anything in California. So I'm like, okay. But one of the things that I always tell people is know the laws, not just of your state, but of the states of where you're also placing people. And know the stuff. I mean, because a lot of people think just because I'm in Timbuktu, Kansas,
okay,
that I can get away with Timbuktu, Kansas's law. No, you can't, because you've got three aspects you got to deal with: the laws of the state of the company, the laws of the state of the candidate, or the laws of the state where the person's going to work.
Okay.
And where they're going to be spending a predominant amount of their time of working, because I mean, for example, let's say construction. If they're doing construction in, say, California, then they're going to have to know the OSHA code, Occupation Safety Hazard Codes of California. So those laws will apply, even though they're a company in Texas. Well, that seems normal to understand, right? Well, the same applies in our industry when it comes to employment. You know, and people go, well, you're thinking, overreacting too much. And this is I had an interesting conversation with someone yesterday about that. They said, why do you care so much? Why do you worry so much? And I'm like, okay. I make over 100 calls a day. Well,
sure.
Average, okay? I don't really make 100 calls a day. I'm very lazy, but an average recruiter makes 100 calls a day. And even if you think you're off the record, even if you think you don't have a web page to keep a low profile, even though you think, you don't even want to put yourself out there and for the world to see, they know who you are. Because every time you pick up the phone and you're dealing with such a sensitive nature of the person's job and their employment,
mm-hmm.
I can guarantee you that there's going to be a person you're going to talk to that you may step up, you may say the wrong thing at the wrong time, he may get sensitive to it, and he will report to you.
So you got to be on the watch out for people who may take things a bit too sensitively.
Or,
even though, you may not, you know, you personally may think, ah, he's blowing it way out of proportion.
Well, or they can also just, or you may just meet that one person who decides, oh, you're a recruiter, I know how much money you make, I'm going to line my pocket because I don't feel like working anymore. So I'm going to just, you know, make a fabricated charge against you, okay? Now, the thing, another thing, too, is that people don't realize, besides just the fact that we're dealing with such a sensitive nature, even if you didn't do anything wrong, the fact is you're going to have to spend near $100,000 just to defend yourself to prove you did nothing wrong.
Ah, I see.
So I don't have that money, and I'm not very rich.
So your chief argument is prevention is the best cure.
Well, when you talk to that many people a day, don't you think that there's a high, strongly likelihood that you could get in trouble?
Okay.
Now, I mean, another thing, too, I always tell people, too, even if you're a corporate recruiter working for, say, Google or IBM or wherever, get yourself your own insurance. Get your own errors and omissions, consultant errors and omissions insurance.
So even if you are an employee of a major corporation, you should still have your own insurance as a recruiter?
Absolutely, because people
well, I mean, but doesn't the company take care of all that kind of stuff? I mean,
I'm going to give you a perfect example. I have a corporation, right? I'm an escort. Somebody could come and try to sue my company, right?
But I'm thinking like a company like IBM, something huge.
Right. So they could come out there and try to sue the company. Well, I can shut my doors, you know, because people think, oh, I have an escort that protects me from liability.
Right.
Well, people are getting smart. They don't just sue the company now. They're also suing the consultants.
They're suing the consultant.
Yeah.
How can they sue the consultant? I've
because
never
you're
heard
the person
that.
Picking up the phone making the error. That's why it's called. That's why CEO insurance is called consultant error and omissions insurance.
Say it again for someone who missed that.
CEO insurance is called consultant error and omissions insurance.
Is that expensive to get?
No. Oh well, I'm going to give you a perfect example. Look at Tyco. Tyco's
All
a huge corporation, right?
Yeah, it's pretty big.
All right. Well, guess what? Who's in jail for doing something wrong instead of just Tyco? Kozlowski.
Oh, yeah.
Kozlowski's in jail. The lawyer's in jail. A whole bunch of other people who are in there involved in this are in jail because they did something wrong. Well, the government has said, too, by the way, you can now sue the people in the board of directors for doing something wrong, not just the company, right? Well, the same thing goes for consultants. You are the one who performed the negative action, so the person who can come after not just you, they can sue you and IBM. They can sue IBM for having hired you, and for having you on the payroll and being responsible for, you know, because you're their employee, and then they can sue you because you're the one who did the you made the mistake.
So
go ahead.
No, then you go ahead.
I was so what problem is like people will meet like myself who have these, you know, they'll go, I want to get a corporation. What kind of should I get, an S Corp, C Corp, LLC? Well, you know, it really doesn't matter what you get, because you're not really protected. If that's the reason you're doing it, if you're doing it for tax purposes, get, you know, then look at your state and figure out which one you want to get. But if you're doing it to protect yourself and your house and your business and et cetera, forget it, really. I mean, because if you're going to – then get insurance to cover your butt, too, because they can come after you, the individual.
Well – that is interesting. Prevention is the best cure for all of this. I haven't really...
Wait, there is one thing I want to talk about, because you brought up a question, how
okay.
often TPRs also do to protect themselves.
All right.
TPR, third-party recruiters, that's the a permanent placement recruiter.
Right.
They, too, can get sued. And a lot of times what happens is that recruiters can get sued. For example, there was an interesting case out there. There's a really large case. It's $20 million, okay?
Yep.
Because they didn't do a very good background check. It was an executive search, and it was a very high-level placement. And this particular CEO has been robbing this particular company corporation blind, just totally robbing him blind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's costing this particular company a tremendous amount of money. So the company is now suing the recruiter for all the damages, for the new hire, for the placement fee, I mean, tremendous. It's near $20 million, okay?
Oof.
And so, like, for example, what you can do to protect yourself at your clause is have a clause in your agreement, have a clause that states you don't do background checks.
Okay.
If you don't do background checks.
Okay.
I don't do background checks, because I make sure I protect myself. If you don't do background checks, put it in writing. You have to have it in writing because the courts will assume that that's what you're supposed to do, and they'll assume that the company assumed that because it's implied that you do if you're full service. And unless you have it in your contract, you have no remedy.
Wow.
Protect yourself completely.
Yes, practice safe recruiting.
It really is. I mean, prevention is really worth it than taking risk. Risk is really
right.
Great. But what I've found, the more I know about the laws, the more I've had to learn to become a better recruiter. The more offensive and defensive I've become, the better I've actually become in recruiting. And I find that so ironic.
Definitely. Let me pause it right here because I know people are thinking that, wow, I've never heard this before, and I've been doing this for years, and I don't really see it affecting me, maybe the next guy. All it takes is one time for it to happen. It's one time for it to happen, ruin your day. I would be very interested to hear people's comments on this. If you would, send me an email, and I'd like to answer some of your questions, or Karen and I will go back and forth and try to figure out the best answer for you or direct you to the right person. You can email me at jimstroud, that's G-I-M-S-T-R-O-U-D, at jimstroud.com. And also, you notice that if you're listening to this from my blog, Jim Stroud 2.0, then there is a button on this blog post where you can leave an audio message. So if you decide to leave an audio message, maybe we'll clip it in the next episode of our podcast. Any last shout-outs or comments, co-host Karen Madden?
Just be careful. Just go out there, do your job, do it well, but be careful. Don't worry about making risks because it's not worth it.
Well, that's it for now. We thank you for your time here in the Recruiters Lounge and hope to hear from you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's it for this show. You've been a wonderful audience. If you like what you heard, love what you heard, or just plain hate what you just heard, let me know. Your feedback matters. You can reach me through my website at jimstroud.com/podcast. That's jimstroud.com/podcast. So until next time, I'm Jim Stroud, and you're not.
Innovative Audio on Demand.